Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we talk through what has been an incredibly busy and somewhat dramatic summer on the legal, regulatory, and enforcement front. Chevron deference is gone, more agency rule challenges may be forthcoming, and the private fund advisor rules were vacated completely. But other than that, it's been pretty quiet, right? So what actually is the impact of Loper Bright? What's next for private fund advisors? And what can all advisors expect from the SEC on the examination and enforcement front in the coming months? To help guide us through these and other important questions, we welcome in two former regulators who have served at the very highest echelons of the SEC in areas like examinations, enforcement, and investment management, Mr. Igor Rosenblatt and Ms. Alpa Patel. Given the gravitas of the subject matter and the guests, this show is structured as another installment of our Lessons from the Frontline series. We've talked about these types of shows before, but for some of our new listeners, the Lessons from the Frontline series focus on real life, tough to tackle subjects that other industry pros and regulators have faced on the front lines of our industry. And if you're anything like me, you may still be in a state of shock and probably a little bit confused trying to unpack everything that's happened over the past 3 months. So given the incredible insights that these two individuals can share, I know the best thing for me to do at this point is to get up and out of the way. And so with that, let's dive into the interview with Alpa and Igor. As we move into the interview section of today's show, we are going to be talking about some of the biggest developments that we've had in the securities industry in 2024, namely a couple different U.S. Supreme Court decisions, as well as the vacating of the private fund advisor rules. And to help guide us through what is an incredibly important topic, and I'd say an incredibly sophisticated and nuanced topic area, we have two fantastic guests here on the show today. First, we welcome Alpa Patel. Alpa is a partner at the law firm of Kirkland & Ellis and in the Investment Funds Regulatory Solutions Practice Group. She focuses on counseling U.S. and non-U.S. investment advisors in family offices across a broad range of compliance, regulatory, and legal matters affecting private funds. She's been ranked in band one of chambers, including recently in 2024 for the investment funds practice. And she really, her practice delves into some of the most complex and sophisticated various issues that are impacting the private funds, you know, industry broadly, including registration, structure, and operations. And also importantly, and we'll find out a little bit more about this here in a moment, prior to joining Kirkland, Alpa served as a branch chief in the SEC's private funds branch of the Investment Advisor Regulation Office, as well as a number of other roles over at the SEC. Joining her for today's discussion was one of her partners in crime there at the SEC during that time frame, Mr. Igor Rosenblatt. Igor founded Iron Road Partners in 2021. He is a leading expert in financial regulation and has really helped impact through thought leadership many of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission's regulatory approaches to private capital markets. He focuses on helping clients successfully navigate a broad range of challenges stemming from both examinations, investigations, litigation, disputes, and other crises. And he uses his experience both having served at the SEC in the Division of Enforcement's Asset Management Unit, and the private funds unit, which I mentioned earlier, to really help provide exceptional service to his clients. Igor, Alpa, thank you so much for taking the time to join the podcast today and to talk about this incredibly important topic.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Absolutely. And it's fun to do this with Igor. As you mentioned, we worked together sort of overlapping at the SEC for many years when he was running the exam program on the private funds side. And I was sort of tasked with trying to figure out how these rules that were written over the years for regular wealth managers were going to apply to private fund advisors. So have collaborated a lot back when we were on the SEC. And now that we're on the outside, sort of working together with a lot of clients.
Yeah. Well, and given that vast experience, I know our listeners are really going to be able to benefit quite a bit from that here today, both having served in the shoes of the regulator and understanding kind of how they're seeing things through their eyes, as well as now on the industry side, some of the challenges, some of the real world challenges that firms can face as they try to navigate some of these complex issues. So let's dive right into the discussion. And now that it's essentially mid-August here, I guess, should I continue to wait for that midsummer slowdown based on news in the securities and compliance industry? Because the summertime seemed to produce quite a bit of noteworthy items, not the least of which included a couple of U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And I thought to kind of kick off today, we will get to the private fund advisor rules here in a little bit. But to kick off today, I thought we would talk about the Loper Bright case in particular, and really part of, you know, what it means, kind of a little bit of what happened maybe in the case itself, but certainly what happened and what is its impact and what are some of the key takeaways that our advisors can take. So maybe I'll start with you if you don't mind, and we can just talk a little broadly about kind of what happened in Loper Bright and what is the long-term impact like to the Chevron doctrine.
Thanks. So Loper Bright was one of these you've sort of been waiting for years and years to make its way up through the Supreme Court, where basically, you know, certainly as a rule writer at the SEC, we had always benefited from this context of deference to the rule writers, right? You have subject matter experts at the various offices throughout DC that make up the federal government. Basically, obviously, at the SEC, it's the Administrative Procedures Act was always read to assume if you meet certain standards of going through notice and comment period and you follow all the APA procedures, the government agency is going to get, quote, Chevron deference, in that these folks have spent years studying this issue. They will go through understanding and will, you know, after sort of receiving public comment, will issue a rule that presumably has sort of the benefit of all of their years of experience. And so they should get some deference when the rules are being basically challenged for not necessarily statutory authority purposes, but for sort of substantive areas in how reasonable of an interpretation from what Congress might have said in a short statute. And so, you know, you take the Dodd-Frank Act, which sort of very vaguely requires certain things of the SEC or other agencies, and then the agency or the commission will go and issue a 300-page rule that explains, you know, their interpretation and their regulation trying to meet the APA requirements. Obviously, that sort of stemmed from a case from way back when, Chevron, and so that's why it's always been called Chevron deference. And Loper Bright basically was saying this isn't sufficient. This is actually the courts are the ones that should be exercising their independent judgment, and the agency should not get deference that they've acted within their statutory authority. So a big shift as to how sort of the federal administrative bodies should think about rulemaking in the first place, where you normally are able to presume that you get to interpret your authority and go from there. But obviously, this is a big issue for not just the SEC, which we all sort of have to tangle with, but every agency in town, basically.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. Igor, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that, at least just kind of at the, you know, at the top level?
Yeah, I think for Loper Bright and also for Corner Post, I think those are both interesting cases. I think they're unlikely to have an effect in the short term around kind of what the SEC does or how the SEC executes its mission. Of course, the long-term effects are unknown.
Yeah, and I'm just going to read a quote here that was from Chief Justice Roberts in kind of making the decision that I think at least tries to try to, you know, encapsulate the court's ruling in the Loper Bright case. He stated, "Chevron is overruled. Courts must exercise their independent judgment in deciding whether an agency has acted within its statutory authority as the APA requires. Careful attention to the judgment of the executive branch may help inform that inquiry. And when a particular statute delegates authority to an agency consistent with constitutional limits, courts must respect the delegation while ensuring that the agency acts within it. But courts need not, and under the APA, may not defer to an agency interpretation of the law simply because the statute is ambiguous." And I think that's a good kind of summation of the court's position, but it does, one of the things that I do find interesting, and I don't know what your all's opinion of this would be, do you anticipate seeing certain agencies, including potentially the SEC, really trying to try to get clean lines drawn from a congressional standpoint where they can have additional authority in certain areas that are going to be, again, as they say, where a particular statute delegates authority to an agency consistent with constitutional limits? So I don't know. What are your thoughts? Do you see maybe the SEC or other agencies trying to pursue additional authority vis-a-vis a congressional statute?
Maybe it's hard to imagine the United States Congress passing legislation that makes much sense these days. So I'm sure the SEC is sort of contemplating, do we want to take that risk? And maybe it'll depend on how the election sort of plays out here in November as to, you know, whether the houses change or not. But you sort of want to be careful what you ask for as well. And you may be better off if you're the SEC to just sort of let this sit and figure out from there, you know, the rulemaking they've got. We'll talk about sort of these other rules, but like it's the same issue of what is our authority from the statute itself, as well as, you know, what is it clear what we can do beyond that. So it's obviously the SEC has public affairs people people that work on congressional mandates and can certainly sort of test the waters to see if they've got sympathetic ears, but I wouldn't hold much hope for Congress doing basically anything these days.
I do think what rules, when they do come out, will have much longer releases than they have in the past. And if you look at the PFAR release was something like 360 pages, and like the Code of Ethics release was something like 50 pages. And so they've been growing already, and they're just going to get longer, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're going to have to really bolster what their statutory authority is and all the reasons why they think they are interpreting it correctly. And you're right, Igor, the rules expanded over the years, and it was always in reaction to litigation, right? So this will just be more PFAR being dropped. And that was obviously more on the statutory authority side. But when you have a rule that's struck down for being arbitrary and capricious, which is normally how these rules go, the answer to that is, well, let me give you more reasons. And that is why, you know, our releases ended up just writing more. The more you can draft, the better, because you're trying to counteract the idea that you did not address some random issue that a commenter raised, you know, in their 600-page comment letter. So that is the give and take and sort of the beauty of the Administrative Procedures Act of, well, okay, you're telling me I didn't do enough, I will do more. And that's exactly where you're going to end up more here.
No, thank you both for that context. I think that's really helpful just to kind of frame a little bit of what happened, not just in the Loper Bright case, but certainly kind of the overall landscape there. You know, Igor, you mentioned corner post, and I guess just real quickly, maybe before we get into the private fund advisor rules and the decision from the Fifth Circuit there, you know, at this point, would you say corner post is emblematic of the kind of beginning of future agency rule challenges, and that this is a harbinger of things to come? Or would you say it's still too early to tell, and that, you know, corner post could just be kind of a bit of an anomaly or more of a one-off type situation, and it's we're still much more in the kind of wait and see kind of time period?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, corner post, pre-corner post, the Administrative Procedures Act had a 6-year statute of limitations. And the way people tended to think about that is that once a rule is enacted, there are 6 years to challenge that rule. And what corner post said is actually the 6-year statute of limitations starts running when someone has first been harmed, which means that if an entity was not in existence at the time, their statute of limitations starts running as soon as they are formed. And that creates the just to back up, for me, I live my life in the private funds space most of the time. And if you look at the enforcement cases in the private funds space, something like 80% of them rely on basically two rules, Rule 20648 and Rule 20647. Those are long, well-established rules that everyone has already accepted. It is not out of the realm of imagination that someone with some funding and the inclination to challenge longstanding rules will challenge those rules and eventually will be successful in having those rules overturned. And in the private funds arena, where so much is riding on just two rules, that creates some, at least theoretical, risk of the entire regulatory scheme basically falling apart. Will that happen? I don't know. Whenever I think of situations like that, I think back to the Goldstein decision, which overturned the requirements for hedge funds to register. And I think about the fact that once hedge funds registered, even though they no longer had to register because Goldstein overruled the hedge fund rule, they remained registered because their investors kind of liked their managers being regulated. So perhaps the same thing would happen, but it certainly opens up the opportunity for the kind of the foundation of private fund regulations to be struck down.
Yeah. Alba, did you have anything to add to that, or would you agree?
I think Igor had a great summary there. To his point about Goldstein, and you think about the evolution of that, like, sort of be careful what you wish for as well. Like, the history is long, and the arc seems to go one way ultimately. Hedge funds, private equity funds didn't have much to do with the financial crisis, but certainly that title went into Dodd-Frank to require them to register just the same. And you know, we're going to talk about the private fund rules and how we've sort of dodged bullets there, but you sort of, there's a lot of ways to get to where the SEC wants to go here. And I think these are the types of scenarios that ultimately investor protection and the mission of the commission will still look through and figure out how are we going to sort of implement our mission if it's not through rulemaking. And Igor's point is right. You know, the history of the SEC bringing these enforcement cases has always been interesting. We've seen a lot more 20647, the compliance policy cases lately. I think, Igor, you'll not agree, but during our time, which was maybe 10 years or so ago, you would hardly see compliance policies and procedures cases stand alone. It was usually sort of a throwaway. They'd find a substantive violation or materially misleading facts. And then at the end, there would be and by the way, they violated 20647 for not having a particular compliance policy or control in place. You're seeing a lot of those standalone policies and procedures cases lately. Usually there's more going on in those cases, and that's just sort of where you landed. But these orders don't say a lot, and there's a lot to be left to understand what's the actual underlining activity that the SEC is taking issue with. But that rule, to your point, has evolved over the years as to what it really means and what the SEC's interpretation of what it means.
Yeah. No, that's really, really excellent kind of feedback there. And I will certainly agree with you both that, I mean, if you look at the kind of overarching arc of the examinations that I've been a part of, the 20647 violations are rarely, rarely ever like the tip of the spear. I mean, it's almost always there's some other substantive violation or violative conduct that's kind of helping to cause that. And as a result of the conduct taking place and them not discovering it or whatever else, they're going to tack on that they didn't have proper controls in place to help mitigate against that kind of conduct. But that's interesting that you're seeing it more and more now as, again, more of the tip of the spear there. But that's a good segue, because I think part of the broader theme that we'll be talking about today is that private fund advisors certainly need to continue to have robust compliance programs and making sure that they're still locked into what are some of the key priorities in the private fund, you know, advisor space that the SEC is concerned about. You mentioned a moment ago, actually both of you mentioned, the private fund advisor rules. So PFAR and the recent Fifth Circuit court decision, which vacated those rules. Maybe just had you, Igor, kind of talk about, you know, corner post. Maybe I'll start with you on the PFAR vacation stuff going on and the fact that the rules were vacated. Tell us a little bit about what happened there, and then we can start to talk about its long-term impact.
Sure. And you know, I'll skip sort of going through what the rules actually were. I imagine your listeners are familiar with this sort of sweeping set of rules that A couple of years ago, Chairman Gensler came out with, had sort of teased them for a couple of months until they finally dropped. And I think everybody was surprised at the level of granularity and scope of where those rules had started. And through notice and comment, by the time they got to the adopting release, it was greatly sort of pared back, and at least relative to where the proposals had started, but still were relying on dubious statutory authority related to the ability of the commission to actually regulate the relationship of an advisor and the investors in the fund, as opposed to just the fund. And so through a lot of, you know, through the litigation that was headed up by the trade associations, ultimately prevailed in the Fifth Circuit, which, you know, is I think everybody would agree, it's just hostile generally to the federal government. And so a well-choiced jurisdiction to bring the case. But when the vacation actually came through, I think everybody was surprised at the sort of quick nature of, you know, there wasn't a ton of analysis as to why that the SEC was sort of being, the rules were being vacated. You know, we thought there were a number of ways they could have addressed the point of arbitrary and capricious, like we were talking about, or just not having statutory authority. And basically they just went for the jugular and said, this is not, you do not have the authority to do this. And not only do you not have the authority to do this, we question what your authority is under 2064, which is the anti-fraud rule, which gives the SEC authority to issue sort of prophylactic anti-fraud rules, which is sort of where we all live, right? As Igor mentioned earlier, there's two rules that you will see consistently in exams or in enforcement, and those two rules emanate from 2064 of the Advisors Act statute. So pretty sweeping sort of statement from the Fifth Circuit. I think the deadlines have passed for the SEC to appeal. And so I think this, you know, fair or not fair, they are sort of living with the result from the Fifth Circuit, and will let it lie instead of trying to either appeal to the Fifth Circuit or to ultimately to the Supreme Court to try to get some clarity on what the authority actually is, and maybe not beg the question about, you know, what does 2064 actually mean, since it's sort of the cornerstone of all their regulatory rulemaking in the private fund space, at least.
Yeah.
And this is just a case in point of why Loper Bright and Corner Post could be so dangerous to the administrative state or the SEC. I think I was very interested in kind of the whole PFAR situation, because it does touch what I do on a day-to-day basis. And from what I could tell, the Fifth Circuit did not understand, it did not much care about the merits of each individual provision of the private fund advisor rules. They just simply applied a philosophy of less regulation and tried, looked like the decision had a lot of cut and paste from the complaint. And is that, and it's hard to believe for me that that's kind of the optimal result from this litigation. I can't say I loved the entire PFAR package. There were components of it that made sense, but clearly the court either wasn't equipped or wasn't interested in considering the details, and that could happen with any rule. And so I guess it's a wait and see, but if you want something overturned and you have the money to challenge it, chances are you'll prevail.
Yeah. Go to the Fifth Circuit. One part of that. But well, let's dive in a little bit to the long-term impact. And first, I'm going to talk about impact with regard to kind of SEC examinations and enforcement and some other related stuff that I want to hear from both of you about. What key areas do you still see the SEC focusing in on now that PFAR is gone, right? And they don't have, you know, specific rules that they can point to. But then I also want to talk about a little bit too, the court's decision in the First Circuit and some of the specific language that, you know, you both have talked about that called out the regulatory authority that the SEC was relying on there. Because I think there may be some other rules proposed right now that are also relying on the same authority, and there may be some additional impact there. But let's start local with private funds, so to speak. You know, now that PFAR is gone, you know, how do you see examinations kind of continuing to what types of approaches do you expect the examination teams to take? And are there any particular key areas that you think you'll continue to see a focus from the staff? Maybe Igor, I'll start with you this time.
Well, I think the vacation of PFAR didn't really change the examination approach of the commission and won't. I think had PFAR stood, there was a pretty good probability that exams would have changed pretty significantly and would have transformed into a group that tests a lot of the PFAR disclosures that were required, but that did not happen. In terms of the areas that PFAR covered, those areas are traditional exam risk areas, and that is why they were in PFAR. It really didn't work the other way around. So in terms of what exam does now, it's really a version of what they've always been doing, which is identifying potential conflicts of interest, identifying potential technical violations of certain rules, including the books and records rule, which is kind of a hot topic right now, and pursuing those in both an exam and enforcement context. And I think the kind of the interesting thing to me is that certainly in private fund regulations, there's things that are definitely wrong, things that are definitely okay, but there's this vast middle gray area. And depending on who your examiners are, what their individual proclivity is, and what the overall tone from the top of the commission is, they choose where in that gray area they want to operate. And at some level, it's a random draw for individual registrants and advisors about how their exam is going to go. So I think the best approach is always to identify your conflicts of interest first, remediate them, and make sure everything is disclosed.
To Igor's point, the question of gray comes up with, well, what needs to be disclosed, right? Beyond just everything. And what we're learning that we're seeing in exams is basically them picking up on particular practices that all of a sudden are problematic to whoever the examiner exam team is. And they are certainly pursuing on exams sort of across the board, but then also pursuing enforcement actions in areas that, or at least referring the enforcement actions over or the exam matters over to enforcement to try to generate an enforcement. And I think part of this is they almost need to bolster the record now, right? They tried to make a rule, and I'm one of the first to complain about the SEC sort of regulating by enforcement. But then when they tried to do regulation, they were told you can't do this. So I think you're going to see more regulation by enforcement to get their message out about particular practices that they find problematic. And there are lots of different themes you're going to see, you know, you're continuing to see from the exams. And if anything, it's more to the case of building the case that they are, this is an area of law that needs regulation and needs sort of very specific principle-based rules. Let me show you by bringing a bunch of cases and showing a bunch of exam issues that get referred. And the more you're able to cite to it, the more sort of groundswell you have to prove from a prophylactic perspective, these principled based rules are required, or these actually more prescriptive based rules are required because there is fraud going on.
Yeah.
Patrick, I would just add two things. I don't know, you could cut and paste this and put it wherever you want in the podcast, but just to back up, advisors are thinking about where to invest their compliance resources, we usually tell them to focus on a couple of things. And this all stems from the idea that in order to be a serious problem, a compliance violation has to be material. So that means that anything that is where there are dollars attached to it, where it's easy to attach a dollar value on it, so expenses, fees, anything like that is automatically going to be material and should be at the top of advisors' lists. More important than that, simplicity is important. Anything that's very complicated for you is going to be very complicated for the commission. And there's nothing that the enforcement division hates more than complexity. So if something is simple and there is a dollar amount attached to it, it's probably something that needs to be remediated fairly quickly. Where if there is something that is complex and it's hard to attach a dollar amount to it, then it could be a risk that you could live with. The issue I see with many of our clients, at least, is that the complexity is scary and they focus on the complex areas first. So I would counsel away from that.
It's a great point. And in both of your remarks there, I find it interesting. You know, you're exactly right, Alba, in that if the SEC tried to make a rule here, we'd say we don't like regulation by enforcement, but they tried to make a rule and they were told that they couldn't. And so that then leaves them with a limited number of other ways in which they can try to ultimately point people towards the areas that they're focused on and the priorities and the things that they're concerned about, especially in the private fund space. Your point, Igor, is a really, really good one. And I'm sure one that will be well received by a lot of our listeners who, if they're in compliance, chances are probably pretty good that they're working with limited number of resources and other stuff already. So the idea of being able to maximize the stuff that they do have and being able to hopefully affect the long-term best impact to their compliance program and finding ways to do that, I'm sure is a good advice for them to hear. I want to stay on enforcement a little bit because you both have kind of touched on it in the course of those last remarks. And I want to dive into, you know, both of these rules are gone. Okay. We are continuing to see examinations and enforcement. I think, you know, there's been a certain, I would say exams and enforcement have been a little bit more aggressive over the last several years than maybe under prior regimes. But what are you seeing right now? And, you know, do you think that Loper-Bright, do you think that PFAR getting vacated, do you think that either of those have significant impact other than what we've already talked about? Or do you think potentially that maybe it even makes the SEC more aggressive on examinations and enforcement? And maybe it would also, you know, love for you to talk about and maybe provide a message for a lot of our fantastic listeners out there about, you know, don't let either of these, the Loper-Bright decision or the you know, PFAR it getting vacated, don't let either of these decisions you know, have you kind of sit on your laurels or get, you know, too comfortable as a result. And maybe Alpa, we'll start with you.
So look, the court cases will definitely have an effect on the actual new regulation coming out of the SEC, right? We've all been sort of on the defense over the last almost 18 months of just an incredible rulemaking agenda coming out of the commission on all aspects, but particularly just registered investment advisors, just an onslaught of new rules that, you know, the biggest, I think, complaint was there's no concern about the cumulative burden of all these new things that are being imposed on advisors. But that's just the rules. As Igor mentioned, the things that we deal with, every enforcement case ultimately comes down to old rules. It's not, the new rules sort of have no bearing on what we're actually really seeing on exams, which is the old tried and true issues that you've always seen. And I can't imagine the SEC being more aggressive than it is. You know, it was aggressive 3 months ago in a sort of magnitude I've never seen, both on exams and enforcement. I can't imagine it getting more aggressive, but I suppose that is their MO these days of really sort of feeling their authority here and trying to push the industry in a particular way and picking up on issues. You know, to Igor's point earlier, like, there are some issues that are sort of obviously problematic that clients should fix, but then there are lots of issues where the SEC is sort of spending a lot of time on exams, a lot of hours digging in to ends that it's not clear to me where they're going. You know, they've decided some particular practice is a problem, but frankly, all the LPs in the fund or everyone in the industry actually does understand what's going on here. And the SEC is sort of feeling like, well, it's still not good enough. And I think that's a level of aggression and pursuit that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And then it's sort of like, in my mind, just a waste of resources when there are truly fraudulent things they should be focusing on. But that is where they're at. And I think, you know, that is not going to change. So while rulemaking coming out of Division of Investment Management will slow down because they've got to figure out what in fact is our statutory authority. Are we in fact hitting all the things that we need to hit? And I imagine their general counsel's office is consistently sort of trying to figure out, you know, when we have these 300 page rules, do we need to be 350 pages? And that pairing will go back and forth within the building between the rulemakers and the general counsel's office. But I don't think any of that has an effect on day-to-day exam or frankly, enforcement proceedings at this point.
But let me hit three themes about exams. And then separately, I have a rant on about just the SEC priorities in general and how they work. But the three here are the three themes that I see as kind of most concerning in our area. The number one theme is that right now, because of the high interest rates and market dynamics, it's just hard to raise capital. And when it's hard to raise capital, a number of things happens. One is there's enormous pressure on marketing materials and investor relations in general, that this is not a great time for that because there's now a new marketing rule that is much more prescriptive than the old marketing rule was. Another thing that happens is valuations come under pressure. And valuations are particularly insidious because most compliance departments don't really have a skill set to go beyond just policies and procedures around valuations. But when you peel the onion, it's all in kind of the substance of it. It's all in the finance and the math. All of the risks and all of the ways evaluations could be manipulated. And of course, that will have knock-on effects on track record. So that's a big area. I've seen exams focus on these issues. We found kind of some exceptions there. And so I would keep that in the back of my mind if I was someone who was out raising money. Associated with this are just the proliferation, at least in the private equity space, of related party service providers of all shapes and sizes. That is at its heart a fee and expense issue. And in private equity particularly, it's kind of a difficult issue to address because in theory, disclosure has to be provided in a timely way. So that investors can agree to accept it or not. But in private equity, funds are locked up. And after a fund is raised and a new service provider is created, it's very hard to provide that kind of disclosure to investors. And so there are all sorts of kind of ways to kind of plug the hole, but that's kind of a theme as well. And in that theme, I'll also throw in management fee calculations, which is both related to valuations, which is to say that the idea that some investments should have been written off and weren't for the purposes of management fees, and also the idea that the management fee basis could potentially be inflated in quotes, inflated in some people's view, because there are some fees charged from related party service providers, or because there was some fund financing used, like a NAV facility, to make additional investments. And the last theme I'd hit, which is I think kind of leading edge, but I'm fairly certain it'll make its way down to even the middle markets, is the idea that the best place to raise capital is from retail investors. And so many firms are now forming business development companies, interval funds, and exploring other ways to access the retail market. A lot of those ways have to do with registered investment companies, investing side by side with private funds, which of course creates 17D joint transaction issues. Other firms are trying to put very illiquid assets in funds with good liquidity, with which I think we've seen before in 2008, I would say. And that I think is kind of a leading edge practice, but I see it spreading well beyond the usual suspects and into the middle markets, both on the hedge fund side and the private equity side. So those are my kind of three themes.
Yeah, no, those are really, really good feedback there. Thank you for sharing that, Igor. I want to stay on enforcement, and I think I'd be bearing the lead if we talked about SEC enforcement and I did not also mention some of the enforcement actions around books and records and text messaging. You know, and when we are recording this podcast, relatively recently, we had a major enforcement action come out with another round of fines come out on the text messaging front. 26 firms got hit, $390 million in total fines. You know, I'll kind of open it up to you both. Do you continue to see the books and records area? I think this latest round probably gives me the answer to my own question here, but I'll ask it anyway, because I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on, you know, do you continue to see this as one of, if not the kind of highest priority item for SEC enforcement? Because certainly we've continued to see this over and over and over and over again. And where do you see it going from here? Maybe I'll start with you.
Yeah, look, on the enforcement side, clearly, right, there are, I mean, it's a little bit of padding the stats here. And to a certain extent, enforcement is in the numbers game where they need to be able to sing for their supper and say we've brought X number of enforcement actions and had X number of disgorgement and penalties. Look, this is everybody is in trouble to a certain extent here. It's really a question from the SEC of how much further you want to continue down the pike. I think since you've seen the first wave of these a while ago, advisors have truly taken heart and gone out of, you know, taken extraordinary steps to make sure they are in compliance here. But if you're looking back, you know, if you're looking back 5 years to the statute of limitations, there's probably lots of issues sort of buried in between, no matter how good your policies were at the time. And so we'll see where they continue to go here. This is still seemingly in the broker dealer space. We know they are talking to some investment advisors. I think the question will be after that, what happens? Do they continue sort of rounding up groups of 20 people and sort of like you see in the pay to play cases every 18 months, just go find some people and you can find some cases ready to go. And hopefully they'll be a little bit more judicious on how they do this, because I think the industry has done a good job of sort of trying to remedy the points. And to be frank, like the technological solutions aren't great. And I think advisors have really struggled with how are we supposed to monitor, you know, some forms of communication, but have really put the time and the resources into to try to get on the right side of this issue. And as Igor will say, like, it's still hard. The surveillance piece is still hard, no matter if you as the advisor do everything correctly. Trying to get it right with your employees is not easy. And if they are going to sort of really pick apart procedures and actual surveillance practices, I think we're in trouble. And I think they, you know, there's sort of not a great answer to that other than hoping that they show some judicious application of the rules here.
You know, I'll tell you what scares me, Patrick. So yesterday, 26 investment advisors and broker dealers were charged for books and records, issues around off-channel communications. In that mix was one pure play advisor. What scares me is really two things. One is the advisor case came out of an exam, and I think it's the first time that has happened. And the enforcement order takes pains to talk about the fact that this advisor actually had good policies and procedures and had attestations and all the things that we recommend to our clients that they have were in place. However, texting occurred anyway, and the SEC writes that off to, you know, poor surveillance. As Alpa said, surveillance right now in 2024 of off-channel communications is very, very challenging. And everyone texts, absolutely everyone texts. So this could create a situation where if you are under exam and your examiners decide, well, they don't like you very much for whatever reason, they could always change the focus of their exam to off-channel communications. Be somewhat sure that even if you have good policies and procedures, something will be found, and be somewhat comfortable that the enforcement division would be open to taking a case like that. And that basically impacts everyone.
Right.
And there's no practical way to defend against it. And that's what makes it somewhat scary.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right there, Igor. And in fact, some of those facts that you mentioned, I have not read that specific enforcement action that came out, the one that you were describing. There are parts of it that seem a little bit similar to Cenvest from a little earlier this year, which I think they also said in Cenvest that they had good policies and procedures. And then I think the issue in Cenvest was also that they said that they could monitor employees, like the policy and procedure said that they could monitor personal cell phones, but then Cenvest didn't. And then the SEC fined them saying that, well, you should have. If you said that you could, and then you didn't get
there. Yeah, I mean, this is Cenvest had a 20647 component. Like it or not, the order basically said Cenvest had a policy, they didn't follow it. Here, there was no 20647 charge, essentially saying that they had good policies and they followed their own policies. But it turns out people text anyway, which they do.
It was just the surveillance part is what you're getting at here.
Well, that's what the SEC said, but Everyone texts. Even if you have great surveillance, someone's going to text.
Yeah.
And it makes it pretty scary because it's just a very open-ended tool for examiners to use when and if they want to.
Yeah. I appreciate those thoughts. And I certainly think and would commend to all of our listeners here that, look, if the most recent rash of enforcement actions related to text messaging wasn't enough, I think both, you know, Igor and Alpa have laid out some really smart feedback here to listen to. And certainly it's a good time, always a good time to go back and check your own policies and procedures and make sure that you're in a good position to properly surveil that type of activity, if in fact your investment pros are doing it. And as they also both articulated, I don't know many investment professionals that aren't doing it. So probably a good thing to make sure you're on top of. Let's use that kind of backdrop from the enforcement side to dig into, I think, exploring, you know, again, we talked about the U.S. Supreme Court case. We talked about PFAR. We've talked a little bit about how that impacts or, you know, helps kind of direct where the SEC might go from an enforcement front. But I'm also interested to talk to you both about, and I kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier in thinking about how the Fifth Circuit struck down the you know, PFAR and the fact that they focused heavily on the regulatory authority that the SEC would have, essentially saying that they did not have the proper authority to make those rules. What do you think is the current state of the regulatory environment right now? And what are the impacts of some of these decisions? You know, I'd be interested in maybe Igor, we can start with you this time, just thinking about kind of like, you know, the rulemaking season and the life cycles that are involved there and how do those things get impacted by larger, broader decisions like this?
Well, this was a Fifth Circuit decision, and so you know, courts in the Fifth Circuit, I suppose, are bound by it. But to review kind of what you just alluded to, there were two pieces of authority cited in the private fund advisor rule. One was a very broad authority under a statute that hasn't been used before called the 211H on the Advisors Act that appear to permit the SEC to prohibit certain practices. There are no rules currently in place that use that authority. And the Fifth Circuit agreed with the plaintiffs in the case that that authority only applies to retail, to the retail marketplace. The other piece of authority is in Section 206 of the Advisors Act, Section 206.4, which actually is the basis for a lot of rules that the SEC has promulgated in the past, especially around the fund business, and is the basis for rules 206.4, 8, and 7. And for 206.4, the court said that they do not believe that there is a disclosure obligation that runs to investors, only to the fund, and that there is no fiduciary duty created between the fund and the investors, which I think is already a longstanding kind of approach that the SEC had. That is a particularly scary notion for the SEC, I think, and probably one of the big reasons the SEC did not challenge this rule going forward, because if 206.4 authority was overturned, at least the bedrock of private fund regulation would go with it, and there would be a little bit of chaos about how the rules would be implemented. Yeah, and I apologize, I just forgot your actual question, Patrick.
You're good. You know, I think you actually started to answer it, but it's a good segue. And I think I'll be interested in your thoughts. But I'm thinking, like, you know, knowing that as the backdrop, do you see from the, whether it's Loper Bright, whether it's PFAR, do you see a significant impact to the rulemaking agenda of what they're going to be doing moving forward? Kind of, you know, is the SEC going to take some time to catch their breath, basically? Because yeah, I think the last 18 months, you mentioned it earlier, has been kind of breathless, I think.
Yeah, look, I think they have to. But look, they, you know, they're going to work every day. The rule writers are still there, talented group of people that are sort of still working on the agenda. It beyond just this, though, you're also in an election year. And so there's still like atmospherics where beyond the sort of shift, the tectonic shift in sort of constitutionality, is inevitably there is an election to be had, likely in a, you know, regardless of who wins the election, sort of speculation that you will still have a change in chair anyway. So even if it stays within the hands of the Democrats, and there is sort of just a, well, there was an agenda and you're always working towards a date. A lot of those rules are, you know, regardless of what's written on the Reg Flex agenda is sort of speculative in general anyway. And I think while some of the issues or some of the rulemakings that were a little bit more sort of borderline, you know, Chairman Gensler himself even came out and sort of said he was going to repropose some of the other ones, like the safeguarding rule and the predictive data analytics, or because they were obviously unworkable on its face before the sort of regulation changes here. And I think you'll still see some rules come out. You know, I think there are still things that are well within their mandate and scope. And I don't think they want to sort of be too beholden to it. And, you know, you want to keep moving. And I think there'll be a few rules that'll still come out, but they will need to make sure it is not subject to litigation. And so there will be a lot of almost infighting between what the general counsel's office is going to be saying about rules and what, you know, the various policymaking divisions want to put forth. So that'll slow the process down. But you were already looking at like an end date with the election where you really aren't, you know, it's sort of faux pas to issue rules leading up to the election to a certain point, and then after the election, certainly if there's anticipated change. So I think we can catch our breath on rulemaking, and the ones that'll come through will probably not be particularly offensive in the way some of the other rules had been, and probably narrow down in scope to a certain extent because they will not want to sort of spread their wings too much. Mm-hmm. I also don't know that, you know, look, PFAR was a big deal and it was worth it to the industry trades to litigate over it. And they don't, I don't think they take those decisions lightly. They understand that is going to be a real wrench in how they work with the SEC once you sort of go on record of suing them. And so it's not something that they would have just decided to do every single time. And so PFAR was worth it because those rules were really stretching statutory authority, really was going to have a burden on advisors. Whether or not, whatever the next rule might be, you know, a cybersecurity rule or an ESG rule, does that really sort of get the juices flowing to say, I'm going to sue over that? I don't know. I don't think so. And so, you know, maybe the ones that come out are a little bit more innocuous and sort of annoying at best, but not life-changing or problematic in the way I think we were seeing with the PFAR rules.
You know, I think those are great comments and totally agree with you. I think it's a good question about with regard to some of these other rule proposals that are out there or others that may be coming down the pike, you know, are advisors and other registrants really going to have kind of the stomach to want to litigate those types of issues? I do real quickly before we kind of close up shop here, I want to circle back because one of the other things I do find interesting, and, you know, I think Igor, you alluded to this earlier, which is that with the corner post case, one of the things that's a little bit scary about that is, you know, look, over a long period of time, lots of different registrants have built huge operational and governance infrastructures to help comply with the existing regimes that are in place. Now, if you might get, you know, a crazy plaintiff or two that want to challenge some of the different agency rules out there, there's a lot to be lost. Like, in this, just as much of, you know, private fund advisors and other folks may have wanted to get rid of PFAR, they may also want to keep the status quo as it is right now, given the kinds of operational systems and other stuff that they have in place. But thank you both so much for coming on the show today. It has been an absolute pleasure having you with us and sharing your invaluable insights in this space on all things private funds, Supreme Court cases, et cetera. Before I let you go real quick, we always like to maybe end the show with something a little bit more fun. So we'll get out of the technical just real quick. And I'll say, look, we're coming up on, I can't believe summer's basically over. My daughter went back to school today. What the heck is happening? Things fly by. But as you look forward to the fall season, maybe share with our guests maybe one thing you're looking forward to over the next couple months. And Alpa, we'll start with you.
If anything, I'm happy for election season to be over. I think this is sort of a nerve-wracking time to be in DC just in general, but it's we are, you know, sub 90 days, and I look forward to no longer needing to sort of be waiting on the edge of my seat to see how this is going to all play out.
Fair. Very fair. Igor?
Well, I was going to say that, but now we'll have to choose something else. I'm going to say I'm looking forward to the end of the fiscal year for the SEC. I think we'll see a, as we always do every September, a flurry of enforcement cases. And as we discussed, there are a bunch of interesting ones in shop. It'll be interesting to see what gets over the transom, what doesn't. And if something doesn't get into over the transom, it's really going to be dependent on who wins the election and how aggressive the next SEC chair is going to be.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for that. Thank you again so much for coming on the show today, and look forward to having you back on the show here at some point down the road.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us, Patrick.
And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Alpa Patel and Igor Rosenblit, for coming on the show today to share their fantastic insights and help us unpack the Loper-Bright and Corner Post decisions, PFAR getting vacated, and what's next on the examination and enforcement front. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance and Context Podcast, or on X using the handle @ compliancepod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceAndContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.